For 50 years, NAIDOC Week has honoured and elevated the voices of First Nations communities, grounded in culture and strong in identity. This NAIDOC Week, celebrate Black excellence with programs like Away, Speaking Out and Word Up. As we mark 50 years of Deadly, this week and every week, right here on ABC Radio National.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Maher. It's Rights Night on the show, rights gained and rights lost. From India, news that the country's Supreme Court has mandated that the nation's 1.something billion people have a right to safe passage on footpaths. We'll be talking to a Mumbai campaigner about the thrills and spills of Indian street life. Now the highest court in the land is paying attention. Meanwhile, in Africa, yet more countries are passing brutal laws against lesbians, gays, transgender, indeed the whole queer alphabet. Dozens of countries on the continent threaten to send anyone having sex with their own sex to prison. It's not just cruel, it's crazy. Since June this year, in the former French colony of Niger, being a guest at a gay wedding can land you behind bars for 20 years. That later, but first, Ian Dunt joins us live from the UK, author, columnist with the Eye paper and co-host of the Origin podcast. Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Ian, how are you? Getting any sleep? I know it's been tough lately with the soccer.
So at this point yesterday, I was trying to have a conversation and I thought, I'm really struggling to remember how to use words from my sleep-deprived brain. So I can't claim that this interview is going to go very well, particularly, but I am just awash with joy. And it's not, we're sort of entered into some weird alternate reality where everything's okay. So politically, things are going very, very well. Nigel Farage is having a terrible time. There's about to be a new Labour Prime Minister. The polling is changing. Reform are in serious trouble. And then the football is just this kind of background pulse. I appreciate this may not quite be the case from an Australian perspective, but this background pulse of just euphoria and delight and like justifiable national pride. And then that's complemented by things, I mean, it just constantly keeps on going well. So Trump intervenes and tries to make the whole World Cup experience absolutely monstrous by injecting his form of corruption. And then immediately, you know, Belgium just showed the American team what the consequences of that kind of action are and provide this kind of moral parable to the whole thing. So again, I'm in an alarmingly good mood, albeit sleep deprived.
Very good. But look, should we take it slowly or just, you know, look, let's just power ahead and see how you go. Now, look, the other day you wrote of Nigel Farage, he is in real trouble. Okay, now we're going to air on Tuesday night in Australia about an hour before Farage is supposed to make some sort of statement. Now, why is he in trouble? What is looming?
So it began a few months ago with a man called Christopher Harborne. He's a Thai-based cryptocurrency billionaire. They're all crypto guys, these guys. It's just like an absolute mark of a wrong one. And he gave Nigel Farage £5 million. Farage has never been able to give us a good account of what this money is for. He initially said it was for his security detail. He claims to be the most threatened politician in British history. What he fails to mention, of course, is that Joe Cox, a British politician, was assassinated during the Brexit referendum with an attacker who was shouting the kind of nationalist slogans that emerged during the Brexit referendum. And there's something really quite appalling about Nigel Farage claiming this victimhood status in that way. Nevertheless, he says he's under security threat. He'll use it for security. Then he turns around and goes, well, actually, I might not use it for security. I can really use it for whatever I want because it was given to me as a reward for Brexit. Then his story changes again. He's just unable to account for what the money is for. It was given to him in the 12 months before he became an MP. Under the parliamentary rules, any donation given to you in the 12 months before you enter parliament that could be seen to have an undue influence on your politics, and it should be remembered that Nigel Farage has been very aggressive campaigning on crypto regulations, or rather the absence of them, you need to declare. He didn't declare it. So he's under investigation for that by parliamentary authorities. There are another two investigations relating to whether he lobbied the Bank of England, what he was doing with properties. And now there is likely to be a fourth, because on Sunday, a major story broke concerning his financial relationship with a man called Posh George Cottrell, a man who was in the background, sort of baby-faced aristocrat type, in the background of countless photos with Farage, who has been giving him all sorts of things. I mean, just giving him back office, giving him functions, staff, transport, accommodation, private security. He allowed him to use his five-story house near Buckingham Palace. He even started paying for his flights within the US once he became an MP. Now, the flight within the US once he became an MP was registered with the authorities, registered late. The other payments, the full extent of this relationship has not been disclosed by Farage until this time. And suddenly, you got this guy who acts like this kind of snarling wolf. He's always the one on the front foot. He's always the one pressing the agenda. Suddenly, he just looks like prey. He looks profoundly vulnerable, in real, real trouble. And look, we don't know what he's going to say in an hour's time when he comes to do the speech, but it is perfectly possible that that could be the moment that he says, I'm stepping down as Reform leader or as an MP.
But just before he does, what does George, this astonishingly childlike, grim figure, what does George call Nigel?
Daddy. I'm so sorry that I have to communicate this to your listeners, and I don't think anything I've ever said to your listeners has helped them get a good night's sleep, but I think the fact that he does call Nigel Farage daddy is probably the least helpful thing I've ever contributed in that respect.
Yeah. I just felt I had to ask the question. Ian, the 5 billion quid given by the Thai-based crypto billionaire Christopher Harborne, how did we learn about that? Did Farage declare it?
No, absolutely not. All of this has been done against his wishes through, just good old-fashioned journalism, really. And then it's very telling. He's been doing a series of TV interviews, I mean, including with very friendly broadcasters. I mean, things like GB News and LBC and, you know, places that always give him an easy ride, let alone the BBC and Sky. And he just cannot keep his temper. So, and it's emotionally and in terms of press relations, it's fascinating, because he's just very good, as Boris Johnson was, at presenting this facade. And the facade is like, oh, I'm just a good old guy down the pub. I like a cigarette. I like a pint of beer. Always sort of smiling, you know, always sort of shot in this way that makes you look like you're really quite different and just a bit of bonhomie. Now, it was false for Boris Johnson. As soon as you started challenging him in any way, he had a very short temper, a very short fuse. The same is true for Farage. So Farage ended up spending an entire day doing broadcast interviews, just shouting into cameras, none of your business, it's none of your business, I'll spend the money how I please. Yesterday, he was accosted by a Sky News TV crew, and just ends up with his face pressed into the camera. You can find this on YouTube. Pressed into the camera going, I'm going to take this up with your bosses. You're threatening my family. You're breaking the rules. You need to stop it now. And you just think, no one's contacted his family. Like, they just don't like it up him. So suddenly that the press attention has gone negative, you see the real incompetence, actually, of his media relations exercise. He's just so used to having it his way that he cannot maintain that bonhomie, that positive facade, when things turn on him.
And he claims to be the victim of some kind of high-class conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, the populists, they always do the same thing. You know the story and you can read it off by heart. It doesn't matter whether they're Russell Brand or whether they're Donald Trump. It doesn't matter. Or Marine Le Pen. As soon as they get in trouble, they say, well, it's an establishment stitch-up. This is the kind of epistemic security that you're given by populism, of anything can be converted into a conspiracy theory against you. And it'll work for, you know, some very gullible, stupid people, but it won't work for most people in this case. So he has said that, I mean, the story that broke on last Sunday was broken by the Sunday Times. Now, the response of Reform is like, well, it's a stitch-up by a Labour-supporting newspaper. The Sunday Times is owned by Rupert Murdoch. It is not some bastion of liberalism and socialist humanism. You know, it is a classic right-wing newspaper. It has been slamming Labour for the last 2 years, starting with their, you know, the reports over freebies taken by Keir Starmer and other members of Cabinet. It's not just that the story doesn't land well on Blue Sky with lefties. It's that saying that the Sunday Times are part of a left-wing establishment is just so laughable to anyone who has even the slightest understanding of the British media or political ecosystem, that again, you just think, well, that's very, very weak. His other problem, of course, is that this guy, posh George Cottrell, is absolute journalistic catnip. I mean, he's like the perfect guy for journalists. He's, you know, aristocratic, smoking, has these mansions everywhere. He's a convicted criminal done for fraud in the US, seeking presidential pardons, having this mansion just by Buckingham Palace. I mean, you put all of those things together, and journalists, no matter how naive they can be and no matter how politically useless they can be, they can't resist the smell of that kind of blood. And so now they're all in as a... That is pack-hunting journalism. They see that there's a difference in the story. They see the colour of the person involved in it, and they are just going to gun that as hard as they can.
Ian, as we went to air, as we are going to air now, Marine Le Pen in France has been found guilty once again of misusing public funds, which could be the end of her political career. And what is it about the far right and money?
I mean, this, by the way, you saying that is just further proof that I have somehow accidentally stumbled into the good timeline. I don't know how this is happening, but apparently all news must be positive at the moment. The corruption thing is a core part of the populist agenda. It is not adjacent to it. You know, most of the models that are replicated, whether it's Donald Trump or whether it's Viktor Orban in Hungary, are modeled on what went on in Russia with Vladimir Putin. And it functions as a complete closed system of incentives. So you take what Viktor Orban used to do when he was in Hungary, before he was ejected. He would take sort of, you'd buy up a newspaper using your oligarch supporters. You would then use state funding to pump the newspaper full of money, primarily through advertising, sometimes just completely made up. For instance, he held a referendum on George Soros. Is George Soros trying to take over Hungary? Let's have a referendum on whether he should be allowed. Complete nonsense, obviously, and anti-Semitic nonsense at that. But it allowed him to pump advertising money through the newspapers that Fidesz, his party loyalists, had bought up. So thereby, the corruption is not a side effect of the politics. The politics and the corruption always go hand in hand. They are a means of accomplishing each other. You're trying to enrich yourself, yes, but then the corruption itself also helps to fund the political messaging that you're trying to spread around the country. It is core. It is in the DNA of the populist project, and that is why every single time in every single country with every single populist leader, you see the same pattern.
Now, look, let's go on to some good news, Ian. Burnham. Now, Burnham is still the one. He will be the next Prime Minister?
He will, yes. There's no doubt about that. There's nothing to challenge.
Now, you wrote the other day, I keep trying to think of a moment in democratic British history which is comparable to it, and I fail. You are tremendously excited about the prospects of Burnham. Why?
Yeah. Oh, I caveat this. So I'm caveating it in copy, not least because, you know, I've been let down before. And there are weak spots in him. I mean, one of them is we just don't know if he has it in him to take really tough decisions. And there is a slight element to his personality where he really does like pleasing people and he likes being liked. And that doesn't always add up to a good leader. However, he gets the structural flaws. He's thoughtful about it. He's thought about devolution and the complete absence of any real kind of local power in the UK. So why do we get such bad decisions on things like transport? Well, it's because those decisions are taken in Whitehall in London, and they don't necessarily know what's best for an urban transit system in Birmingham. We shouldn't have a situation where Whitehall, and this is genuinely true, makes decisions about whether you're allowed to fix a school roof in the Pennines. You know, that is just a completely insane way to behave. He gets that. He wants to change it. And unlike other prime ministers, he has put devolution, local financial, economic power, decentralization at the heart of his political project. He is speaking it clearly. He's saying to the civil service, prepare to do it. He's saying it to the party, prepare to do it. This is the main project. It's what must happen. Then secondarily, we have this element to him, which is the electoral reform element. And actually, it was one of the things that I thought was most striking about how your politics had managed to survive populism really pretty cleanly in Australia compared to what was going on in the UK. And part of the reason for that, I thought, was the electoral system. Now here, He is a longtime supporter of electoral reform. We urgently need it, unless we're going to keep on falling into a situation where you could get a reform government with complete control of the executive on what, 26% of the vote, 27%, like barely a quarter of the voting public.
Yes.
So he there is saying, look, we're going to make the change. I believe that he's going to push forward towards that change. These are the kind of changes that he's talking about then. It's not like it's one policy. He's talking about working in the engine room, changing the structural manner in which British politics operates. We just haven't had that in my lifetime. And just being on the brink of it, feels like, sure, it could go wrong. He could go wrong. Maybe he won't be that great in the end. But there are very, very good reasons to be optimistic right now.
And one of them, perhaps, is that this man sat in the House of Commons for something like 16 years and put it behind him. And he's coming back to the House of Commons. And putting it behind him at the time seemed to be his deepest wish, and yet he's back.
I think this is spot on. It's the sort of psychological drama behind it already. Like he was quite robot-like when he was a minister, for instance, health minister under Gordon Brown, and he was just a classic sort of New Labour guy. None of us thought anything of him really. And then he left and became Manchester mayor, and he found that support base and he found his voice. And so now when he talks about what needs to be fixed in Westminster, it's not this sort of abstract issue for him. It's almost like it's been embedded in his personal journey, in his sense of his own individualism, of who he is, of his sense of identity. So in a way, it's like grappling with his own past. I did an interview with him for my last book. And he just sort of kept on saying, like, Westminster makes a fraud out of you. Like, it made a fraud out of me. It sort of robbed me of my true authentic self. And so now when you see him talk about, you know, we're going to do something about the party discipline system. We're going to stop this thing where you can just whip MPs into voting on things that they don't even know what they're voting on. They've never read it. They have no idea what it is that they are doing, let alone exercising any independence of mind. Now, when he wants to change that stuff, it is part of a personal journey that he's undertaken, that this is the culmination of. And this is the thing. It's easy for politicians to say certain things, and they will always say it about devolution and about, you know, Westminster reform. It's different when someone has based it as a core part of their identity, and when before they even enter Downing Street, they make that big statement, as he has done, as saying, this is what it's about. This is the mission that I'm pursuing. This is what I expect everyone to get behind and try and coordinate so that it's what we deliver on. That feels like a really fundamentally different moment for Britain, one that is quite unlike any that we've had in the country's modern history.
Ian, thanks for joining us again on Late Night Live.
Pleasure.
Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, our regular commentator in the UK. Coming up, Africa's cracking down on gay men and women. Simply identifying as gay, lesbian or queer in Ghana will earn you 3 years in the slammer if that country's president signs into law the Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill passed in May. 3 years is also the punishment for consensual sex with your own sex, while speaking up for LGBTIQ plus rights could see you behind bars for 10 years. Times are tougher than ever for gay men and women in Africa. 34 of Africa's 54 countries have laws against same-sex relations. In Uganda, men having consensual sex with other men, ditto women having sex with other women, now face life imprisonment or in some circumstances death. Old British colonies that inherited anti-gay legislation from the mother country are tightening these old colonial laws. Former French colonies are criminalising homosexuality for the first time. To discuss, I'm joined by Larissa Kojwoy, a queer feminist from Cameroon based these days in Lyon. Larissa is a researcher with Human Rights Watch, focusing on LGBTQI plus issues in Africa. She's also a lecturer in political sociology, both in Cameroon and France. Larissa, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
Larissa, what is happening in Ghana?
What is happening in Ghana is also happening in different places in West Africa, as well as other parts of Africa. we have political leaders who are trying to manipulate the anti-LGBT rhetoric and narrative for their own political gains, and they disguise it under fighting against Western values, which is unfortunate because Ghana is considered as an example of a democratic state on the continent.
Larissa, I see that the legislation was introduced into the Ghanaian parliament by a Christian clergyman. So is this not a Christian mission to outlaw homosexuality? I mean, it's we're very familiar with it in this country.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of clergymen who are pushing for that legislation, and they are backed up by Christian conservative groups in the US, as well as in elsewhere, like in Russia, for example, and in Europe, because they give them enough infrastructure to move forward with anti-right legislation on the continent. They are part of, I would say, an ecosystem of nationalistic movement who are fighting against what they call gender ideology. So there's a convergence of factors that makes it being what we're seeing today, not only in Ghana, but also in other countries like Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, Senegal, and we've seen it in Uganda as well.
Larissa, this rhetoric about African values, is there, in fact, an ancient, traditional African hostility to same-sex relations?
You know, there are studies who show that same-sex sexualities and people with non-conventional identities have existed before. They have existed, they were accepted in society, they were filling specific roles, and the type of violence that we are seeing now, this is something that is new. That's why some people have said that it's not homosexuality who has been imported in Africa. It's homophobia. But the homophobia we're seeing now is different from what we could have witnessed before. I'm not saying that same-sex sexuality was something that was encouraged. It has always been something that was behind doors. I mean, sexuality in general in most African societies is not something that is out, that is visible. It's something, you know, seeing people having open affection, attention, gesture in public, this is new. And it's new, it's mostly young people who do that, but the sexuality itself was not something that was overt, okay? So even homosexuality or same-sex sexuality was also something that was hidden. I think the problem is with the media, with a lot of things that we're seeing happening elsewhere, marriage equality, and, you know, people in the show happily navigate in between genders and stuff, it lands differently in countries who have had such a heavy colonial past. Because for hundreds of years, for centuries, it has been even our legal systems, the legal systems we have in place in many countries, like in Ghana, for example, it's a colonial legacy. So the written part of what is allowed and what is not, this comes from the colonial era. But it doesn't mean that in customary law, things like this did not exist. I've heard stories of when people being caught, they were different punishment than what we have now. And in other places, it was even accepted for women, for example, to have wives, and for men to have lovers, like men lovers. But the way it was lived, it did not really disrupt the hegemonic heterosexual norm, like having a family, being together and having kids. Why? Because family or marriage was not something that you decide that I want to marry this person. Family are at the core of why people get united, why people marry. So it wasn't really an option to have a partner of the same sex. But you can have a love life, a sexual life, that was really clearly separated from the conventional, what the society is awaiting for you. And that's why even today, the fracture is happening, because there is this thing about this is not Africa, meaning living like this, like claiming that identity and living to that standard, that's something that was not really part of the most of African culture.
So
this separate individual sexual life with what you own to the community. You, as part of the community, are responsible of, you know, living through those standards. But we can accept, you know, having lovers and stuff like that. But being married and claiming that, okay, as a man, I want to go and marry that man, this is different. And people are resisting that strongly based on that argument.
So what's happened is the importation of a European idea of living openly that violates the old notions of living privately and discreetly. And it's that openness, perhaps, that is the real target of this legislation, to make it hidden again.
Yes, but when it's hidden, it's also where violence occurs and happens. Just because it's open or public, it doesn't mean that it would disrupt or it would change the way people relate to their culture or who they are. I think it's a convergence of things. Yes, we have this openness and the way sexual identity or sexual practices are lived elsewhere, we kind of clashes with the way in most African societies these things are being lived. But we shouldn't disconnect it from a clear political project that is not only African, that is global. We shouldn't separate it from religious influence that is getting stronger and stronger. And we shouldn't separate it by, you know, social and economic conditions. Because when leaders, when they play on that popular, it's not even a popular demand, on that anti-LGBT sentiment, they are claiming sovereignty, they are claiming national values, and it's in response to a perceived Western pressure. And that pressure exists not only on LGBT, but also on other human rights aspect of life. Another factor is also the weaknesses of institutions. We don't have, it's difficult to find strong institutions in most states. And it is, we can see that also with the regional institution, the African Union, for example, or different regional institutions, they do not have that strong influence on their member states.
Larissa,
so it's
what,
a convergence of things, yes.
Larissa, what institutions are you referring to here?
The African Union, for example.
Yes.
The African Union, and it's been 12 years now, or 11 years, has adopted a resolution banning discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But no state, it's difficult to find states outside of maybe South Africa. It's difficult to find state who can claim that. They all dismiss that resolution. But it's a regional instrument, and they have all signed the charter, the African Charter, which is the central, the central infrastructure on the human rights, regional human rights system.
Yes.
So, yeah.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Larissa Cojuoi, queer feminist from Cameroon, about LGBTQI issues in Africa. So, what kinds of laws have been passed most recently?
Laws that goes beyond criminalizing same-sex sexual conduct, but also identity. It means claiming that you're lesbian, gay, or trans can expose you to prosecution. Also, there's this vague worded legislation on promotion. People don't really know what is inside promotion, apology of homosexuality. It means that journalists can be persecuted, lawyers, human rights defenders, people working on sexual and reproductive health rights. So supporting, financing also individuals or organizations can expose you to prosecution. So they are making sure that not only being LGBT is a crime, being, not doing, not
yes,
doing,
just being.
Just being, it's a crime, but also defending the human rights for that person can also be seen as a crime.
So the work you're doing is a criminal offence in some of these countries?
Yes, yes. If I go to some countries, I can be arrested for promotion of homosexuality, unfortunately.
And in Ghana, the proposed law there makes it, obliges landlords, if they become aware that their tenants are homosexual,
yes,
they have to be denounced to the authorities.
Yes, there is a duty to report in that law. In extremis, they have introduced some amendment to that law saying that lawyers, journalists, or health professionals are not part of people who can be prosecuted under this law. But even that argument means that they are quite aware that it's unconstitutional to refuse. It's unconstitutional to just make the existence of someone
a crime. Yes.
They are confident on that, because why would they say lawyers are exempted, journalists are exempted, or health professionals are exempted? They are doing their work. They are doing their job.
But in order that the law survives, I'm curious, Larissa, what are AIDS rates like in these countries? Is this good for dealing with the AIDS epidemic?
There is clearly a public health consequences to these laws. As you know, as elsewhere in the world, LGBT rights are it's through HIV/AIDS policies that we've seen. We haven't seen an epidemic with such a huge political component before. It's because LGBT people thought that medication for HIV were available and for free. It's because they are fought for medical examinations, for treatment, for so many things. And through that, in African countries, it was complicated to reach out. These were the people who were hard to reach. And I remember even political leaders saying, we don't have homosexuals here. And people were laughing in the back. Like, it's not because it's not there. They're not getting married. They're not, you know, living out freely that it doesn't exist. Because we could see with the HIV prevalence rate that it was quite going up and up. And we know who were the people the most at risk. And something that it's important to know is that in most of these countries, men who have sex with men are also married to women, and they have kids. That's why it was even harder to reach out to them. So a lot of community workers manage to organize themselves to reach out to those people, to reach out for test, to reach out for treatment, to reach out for a lot of different services that they couldn't have when they go to a usual or a regular hospital. And that's why we've seen prevalence rate going down. And the case of Senegal is typical in that regard. If it wasn't community health workers, the prevalence rate that we have in Senegal right now would not be what it is now. And it's clear that with what is happening, you know, people being targeted, arrested, there's nearly 200 people in prison right now in Dakar and in other cities in Senegal who have been arrested over homosexuality charges. And their HIV status is used as an aggravating factor, because for them, when you're HIV positive and you have sex, you are transmitted, deliberately transmitting HIV/AIDS. So there's clearly a violation, not only of the medical confidentiality, but also on people's, you know, privacy, right to privacy. And people, I was in Dakar 2 weeks ago, people are clearly, even doctors are clearly saying that they have seen a drop, like a huge drop in their centers. They used to receive maybe 20 to 25 people a day. Now it's less than 10. And that's a sign. That's a huge sign that the public health consequences of what's happening will be really, really, really devastating if it is not redressed in time. So yes, there will be clearly consequences.
I mean, the endless nastiness of human beings.
Yes, it is. It is really crazy.
And the fear.
But not, there's this thing about how the media portray the things and also the reality. Right now, clearly, things are the worst as they used to be. But I travel in those countries and I've seen solidarity taking place. I've seen people that you cannot even imagine, you know, trying to hold on a little bit. So maybe there's an opportunity now for local activists to step out. I know it's dangerous, but with these laws and everything, it will be complicated for an international, for someone, people from outside or organization from outside to have that change. And that change can only come if it is rooted in a not only LGBT right, but a more sustained and consistent human rights framework. It means that human rights defenders should take this question seriously, but they are not there yet. They will be when they will know and when they will understand that by targeting LGBT people, it's not only individual rights that you're targeting. It's the freedom of expression. It's the freedom of assembly. It's the right to access to education, the access to health. So a lot more than only LGBT rights. This is slowly happening. And I hope that, like we've seen in Hungary last year with the Pride event, and I hope that in 10 years, maybe I'm optimistic. in five, 10 years, I hope that we can see like a really strong convergence of human rights defenders defending all human rights, including the human rights for LGBT. But we have a long way to go. But everything is not, lost. Huh? I'm a queer African myself, and I... what I've seen, yes, is distressing, but there's also some pockets of hope.
Larissa, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Larissa Kodjoy, a queer feminist from Cameroon based these days in Lyon, who is a researcher with Human Rights Watch focusing on LGBTQI+ issues in Africa. Coming up, another right to walk safely on a footpath in India. Ray, there's a gap in the traffic, I called and plunged in. The scene still haunts me all these years later. Jaipur, six lanes of traffic, no pedestrian crossing. The locals somehow drifting through it all. I did too, but Ray came a cropper, hit by a bicycle, her kneecap broken. I blamed India, she blamed me, and still does, despite the loving care I showed getting her back to Delhi and flying her home to Sydney. All this came flooding back to me when I heard the other day that the Indian Supreme Court has proclaimed the right of every citizen to walk on a safe footpath, and that that right takes precedence over the needs of cars and trucks. Joining me now to discuss this development and the footpaths of India is the environmental activist Rishi Agarwal, founder of the Mumbai Sustainability Centre and the grassroots advocacy group Walking Project, which is campaigning to make Mumbai's streets safe for pedestrians. Rishi, welcome to Late Night Live.
Great. Thanks, David, for having me.
Rishi, why are Indian footpaths such a mess?
Oh, God, I wish I had the answer for that. But all that we know is that they are a mess and we are trying to improve them. But just to answer, give a direct answer, I think it is kind of a fascination with the cars. I mean, maybe it's taken as something like a lowly means of moving around, and the focus is so much on cars as seen as a symbol of development, and a very kind of incorrect understanding of what roads should be. So it's following a very archaic, maybe Western model, America or Europe at one point of time, 70 years back, that fascination with automobiles and pushing every other mode of transport, walking, cycling, out of the way. And we seem to be kind of having a time warp.
Yes, but there's a lot of life on Indian footpaths.
Yes, I always hear that. Anybody coming from the industrialized West, they always, I think, mention the same thing that, it's a lot of chaos. But yes, I guess I agree with you that there is a lot of life and there's a lot of activity, and you got to see so much different people carrying out their trade. But yes, there is a lot of life, and that also, that's a nice feature. And we just hope we could combine best of both the worlds, have a great, safe walking experience, and also enjoy the vitality and all the buzz on Indian streets.
Is there a sort of feeling that cars are for the wealthy while footpaths are for the poor?
It is. And in the Indian context, also need to understand the caste system. I always keep saying that somehow the caste system in India pervades almost every area of functioning in India. And it's kind of seen that, but that's kind of incorrect and also unfortunate, because when you see Indian streets, inevitably everybody is walking, and whether you are wealthy, whether you are poor, and that neglect is really very unfortunate. But yes, increasingly what we've seen in the past 20-25 years is that there is a set of affluent people who now no longer walk on the streets, and they are mostly going point to point in an air-conditioned car. If they need to walk, they're treating it as an exercise and they'll go to a park, or they'll go to the gym and walk or run on a treadmill. And they don't want to be associated with the streets. And that has led to a kind of neglect of the streets.
Are there also people not affluent who can't now use the footpaths because they're too dangerous, too crowded, too overwhelming?
So see, Mumbai presents the greatest case study, and that's why we anchored Walking Project in Mumbai. Because it's one of the most dense Indian cities. It's very compact. It has got sea on both the sides, three sides. And it's just about 5 to 10 kilometers wide at places. And when you have so many people packed in, walking becomes a very natural mode of transport. You would reach much faster if you were walking 1 kilometer. Whereas you might be stuck in a traffic jam during peak hours. So it is a city which naturally lends itself to walking. And that's what, I mean, people are forced to walk. And we're saying that, the modal split is that This is age-old numbers, 15 years back. 15 million walking trips happen every day.
Every day?
Every day, 15 million walking trips. So that's a huge number. And we are saying all of these walking trips are not necessarily safe or enjoyable. And people don't have any option because the car ownership is still very less. And we keep pointing out that every public transport trip involves some amount of walking on the last mile. So you might walk 100 meters, 500 meters, 1,000 meters, but if you have to catch a bus or a train or a metro or a subway, you have to walk that last mile. And we're saying just improve the walking experience for these 15 million people who either don't have an option or are making a choice because they're fed up of the traffic.
You have this beautiful argument that the footpaths, the pavements, should hold spaces for ideas. What do you mean by that?
I mean, we're saying footpaths should be an expression of so many things. I mean, if you make them really kind of, it's really the life of the street, we feel. Because if streets are only for cars, then we know, I mean, the cars are just zipping by, nobody's going to stop by. But streets provide for self-expression for people. People are either engaging in a trade or fashion or having a conversation or eating at their favorite outlet. And it's really important that, I mean, that's the whole idea that footpaths are important for more things than just walking and as a means of mobility.
And to give you, if things are going well, time to think.
Time to think, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, from an exercise, from both psychological and physiological health point of view, it's relaxing and it's giving you time to think, absolutely.
Rishi, what has the walking project been able to achieve in Mumbai?
I think what we've achieved, and it's almost 16 years now since we started off, is that relentless kind of pressure on the municipal corporation to not neglect pedestrians. And that has led to, especially in the past 10 years, we have some of the finest of footpaths having been constructed in Mumbai. I remember till 15 years back when we started, we had to use images from London and New York and Paris saying that, oh, we need footpaths like they are in Manhattan. Now we don't do that because we are saying, okay, there is this part of Mumbai where maybe just 1 or 2 kilometers of footpaths have been built to international standards. And we want you to replicate the same footpath across the rest of the city. So because previously what used to happen is that people used to say, oh, this can be done in a Manhattan, but it cannot be done in a Mumbai. Now we are saying we're not using a Manhattan example at all. We are saying it's been done in one part of Mumbai. Please do it in another part of Mumbai. So we've been through our advocacy and relentless pressure also shape public opinion because people had been very resigned. We do a lot of community walks. We do a lot of community talks. There is something called as the Indian Road Congress, and the Indian Road Congress has pedestrian guidelines. And we've educated thousands of people who never knew how to design. I mean, they were very surprised. They said, we never knew that there's so much of thought goes into building a good footpath. Anybody can build up a bad footpath. I mean, it's very easy.
Yes.
But it's a lot of science and art and thinking which goes into building a good footpath. So we've been educating people about what the height should be, what should be the width, what should be the surface quality, the curb slope, so many things. So we've done a lot of work in the past 15 years. We're just trying to move the needle. Unfortunately, it doesn't move as fast as we would like it to move.
So Rishi, you must be thrilled with the Supreme Court's decision, giving every Indian citizen the right to a safe, good footpath.
No, I'm definitely happy because it helps our efforts. And it's always good to have a sound legal backing and a foundation to the work you do. Otherwise, people take you to be fools who are wasting their time. But yes, the Supreme Court order definitely provides a kind of a fillip. And of course, I mean, I gave the interview to Times of India last week, but I keep saying there is something called a necessary and sufficient conditions. It's by no means sufficient at all, because we know how so difficult it is negotiating institutions who are responsible for safe footpaths. The municipal corporation, the regional development authority, the road department, it's a nightmare dealing with them. And I don't think they are so impressed by Supreme Court judgments. So it's still a tough uphill battle.
Does the Supreme Court have in mind that the crossings of streets as well as footpaths along the street will be safe for pedestrians? This is a personal question I'm asking you here.
So the Supreme Court, no, absolutely. And the Supreme Court has specifically addressed that need of crossing. In fact, even in Bombay, the Bombay High Court has clearly said that if you're a pedestrian, it's not that you're just walking straight in one line from A to B. You might need to cross across the road for whatever reasons. Yes. And your crossing should be safe. And you've raised a very valid point. It's a very painful point for me, because especially over the past 10 years, we've seen crossing the road become far more dangerous and really very difficult than just walking in a straight line.
Does this mean, the Supreme Court's decision, does this mean that you or the Sustainability Centre or the Walking Project might be able to sue a city for not providing safe footpaths?
That's a great point, because I wrote an article 10 years back. The Bombay High Court gave that right. Unfortunately, people do not use it to the extent that they should. And so many cases just go undocumented. And I keep saying that it's only the serious instances where somebody's lost their life or there is a serious injury that it comes into the newspapers. But on a daily basis, you'll see small accidents take place, people slipping, twisting their ankle, falling on their face in a worst case, people fall into manholes because the manhole cover was not there. So a lot of these instances, and Mumbai is a busy city. Everybody's running around all the time. Nobody has the time to go and file a police complaint or take it up. And that's why we keep telling people that if you strengthen advocacy groups, then on your behalf, we can go ahead and do the necessary legal activity. But yes, I think with the Supreme Court order coming in, people can sue their municipal corporation. And I hope more people choose to do that.
Do many die on footpaths?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't have the granular numbers, but 20% of all the road deaths in India, the road accident deaths, 20% are pedestrians. And the overall number is really very embarrassing and shocking. It's closer to half a million deaths on Indian roads.
Not a safe place.
Yes. And besides the safety, I mean, I keep saying that the slow poison is really the anxiety. Your daily walk should not be filled with anxiety. Nobody is measuring anxiety. People are measuring loss of life and when an accident takes place, but nobody is measuring your daily walking experience should be joyful. It should be liberating. That is when you'll be able to think. Right now, all the thinking you're doing is watching over your shoulder and being stressed, and you have to look left, right, and yet you won't be safe. So, yeah.
Rishi, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Great. Thanks, David. I hope it was helpful.
I've been talking to the environmental activist Rishi Agarwal, founder of the Mumbai Sustainability Centre and the grassroots advocacy group Walking Project. And that's the show. On our next, since it was published a couple of weeks ago, a tell-all account of Trump's presidency by two New York Times journalists, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan, has sold over 300,000 copies. It is the real deal. And we're talking to the Australian on the team, Jonathan Swan.